It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
There was a whole year where we were putting in punchlines about the Mets because it worked with the nine Mets fans who were running cables and working cameras and the security guards. And I think that the audience at home, even for people in Europe who don't get Mets jokes,
right,
they got that the joke wasn't the Mets joke.
No.
The joke was that I was a comedian who was pandering to the only nine people in the room.
Right.
And the show just took on a new dimension because of that.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Really big day today. We're excited to launch our first ever kind of thematic miniseries, a special four-part miniseries we're calling The Future Of. And the idea of it goes like this. For me, I have found it increasingly difficult to think about the future in a way that doesn't feel bleak. I'm laughing because that's my coping mechanism for that fact, but been kind of a rough few years. I'm speaking to you right now as there's a land war in Europe following the once-in-a-century pandemic and American democracy under assault, and the IPCC report issuing increasingly frenetic and dire warnings about our climate future. And so it's very easy to get into a sort of dystopic frame of mind, but I also think that dystopia is enervating. I think that dystopia makes us feel hopeless and glum and like we can't build a better world. And I think that we can build a better world. And I think even if we can't build a better world, we should think about how we would build a better world, because that's the only way we retain a possibility of building a better world. So let's think about what a better future would look like. And we've got answers to that question and more with this really sort of interesting and eclectic lineup of guests, including Cathie Wood, who's founder, CEO, and CIO of ARK Invest, authors and podcasters, Anne Freeman and Aminatu So, and Jonah Goldman, who's a managing director of Breakthrough Energy. You may know Breakthrough Energy as the network that's backed by Bill Gates of public and private partners trying to get to net zero emissions by 2050. But first up in our series, someone who I consider a friend and a colleague, and I'm an admirer of his work, and someone who I think has been navigating this moment in entertainment as well as anyone else as we come off this once-in-a-century pandemic, this insane disruption to the basic contours of how entertainment works, about how comedy works, about how communicating to audiences on various platforms works. I thought the best person to talk to about broadly the kind of future of entertainment, like, how are we going to talk to people, communicate to people, entertain, make people laugh across platforms in this new age as we come out of the pandemic? The best person to talk to about that is my friend Seth Meyers of Late Night with Seth Meyers. And without further ado, here's our conversation on the future of entertainment and a lot more. So Seth, you're back. You're back in 30 Rock. You're back in front of an audience.
Yeah. We did it.
You did it? Well, you know, it's funny because it was interesting to watch the trajectory of Late Night during this period, because it's so dependent on a bunch of formal pillars, like the desk, the suit, the crowd, right? Like the band. These are all the things that comprise the genre that is Late Night.
Yes.
And then one by one, they were taken away. And I felt like it was fascinating to watch you guys reinvent it, because literally the things that were the signifiers to the audience, you are watching Late Night from a genre perspective, were not available.
Yep.
So you guys had to do something else.
It's interesting because the audience went along with it, which was the best part, right? And I don't know if they would have had there been no pandemic and just one of us chose to do it this way. If all of a sudden,
hey, it's me in a t-shirt in my room.
Yeah, or I'm going to do it from an attic. And I think that's what people want to watch. But, you know, again, it's that necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right?
Yep.
So that forced us all to not just retreat from the studios for health and safety reasons, but also figure out a way to still make the show. And my personal journey through it after a lot of technical hiccups and those headaches, I felt closer to the audience than I'd ever felt before because I was just doing it alone into an iPad. And I have come to the conclusion that most people, when you do a show like mine, or maybe they're watching it on TV, but often they're watching it off an iPad, often they're watching it off their phone, and almost all the time they're watching it alone at 12:30 on a weeknight. I don't think it's a communal viewing experience for a lot of people. And so it felt like me in a room with a lot of people who were in a room.
Right.
And without that audience of 180 people, which had sort of been this buffer between us, there was this real connection. And that grew from the fact that the only way I could find out what people thought about the show was reading YouTube comments, which was, which had some, look, you had to get through some stuff, but has been.
Wait. I have a bit about YouTube comments. I'm going to give you my 30-second bit about YouTube comments, which is that
great.
When the apocalypse happens and the aliens land the planet charred, that if they ever find the YouTube comments, they'll be like, oh, well, this was clearly, yeah. this was what these people were headed towards. I mean, that's uncharitable.
That is uncharitable. And look, you have to do some sifting.
Right.
But the YouTube comments for my show now are a far more positive place, partly because I have encouraged people to criticize the show. And this, again, totally born out of the pandemic, but I do this thing now every Thursday after we tape our last show of the week called Corrections, which is just on YouTube, where yep. I go through 20 different things that people have complained about over the course of the week and address them, but it's done sort of lovingly. I'm fake yep. mad at them for being jackals. And they, you know, I think they appreciate that there's a thing just for them.
Well, you've built a community there. That's the key.
Right.
It's not yeah. just, it's not drive-by. Like that, you know, like it's not. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so fascinating to hear you say this because one of the things when you talk to comedians, they'll talk about like the word in comedy world, right, is room. Like that's a good room. That's yeah, a bad yeah, yeah. room. And the reason for that is there is a dynamic interplay. Fundamentally in comedy between the person selling jokes and the people laughing. And like,
yep.
that's irreplaceable at a certain level. And it's what you're saying is like, you built a new room. Like you basically built a virtual room.
Yeah. And I think the metaverse is going to work. No, I don't know. And again, this is why, and I should say hashtag ad. This is why the future of Facebook. No. But you're right. Like, we established rules, and the deal was if you want to come have a good time and be a part of this weird play acting, you guys nitpick, and I will respond.
Right.
And we'll have a really fun time doing it. You know, even when we talk about rooms, it was the room for a long time, for a year almost, was just the crew, and they were their own kind of room. But the audience at home understood the rules of that. And so there was a whole year where we were putting in punchlines about the Mets because it worked with the 9 Mets fans who were running cables and working cameras and the security guards. And I think that the audience at home, even for people in Europe who don't get Mets right. jokes, they got that the joke wasn't the Mets joke.
No.
The joke was that I was a comedian who was pandering to the only 9 people in the room.
Right.
And the show just took on a new dimension because of that. And another thing that has happened, you know this, but we used to tape our show at 6:30. And because of that extra time, we would do a test audience. And the test audience was just 40 people in 30 Rock. That we would round up, and I'd read the monologue off paper, and then I would read A Closer Look in street clothes, in
right.
what now are my show clothes,
right,
but in
right.
then where was dressed down.
And not, I should say, like, I've watched this on the closed caption of the monitor inside.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because you're doing it in this, like, you're kind of going at half speed almost. Like,
yes.
it's not, like, you're not performing it, you're sort of just going through it. So it's a sort of interesting thing to
yes.
watch.
Yes, it was enough to set a level for knowing what jokes worked versus other jokes.
Right.
But part of that was those 40 people were the least likely to go for the most esoteric jokes. They were often Norwegians who were on their way from the Lego store to the tree. And so that, by losing that test audience, we then had to put our faith in the jokes we liked, which now we do with a lot more confidence after having done the show for 2 years with no audience. Like, we know what works now. And in a weird way, sometimes we have to weather those moments where the joke doesn't work in the room because we value that at-home audience more because they're the ones that are more likely with us every night.
It's so fascinating because when you come back to it, right, like you have these two audiences and I found, you know, I have a tiny little experience of this, not in a comedy space, but we did this live show.
Yeah.
And there were times where like modulating what is for them in the room and what's, you know, they're not the actual audience because you're broadcasting to million people. But because you're a performer, all you want is what those eyeballs in that space give you. That's everything. And I would even watch, I would be up there and I'd be like, that monologue killed. It killed. Like I saw I had them. And then I'd go back and I'd be like, whoa, that was like a lot. You need to calm down. Because the medium back through the screen is very different than that room, you know?
One of the things that our producer, Mike Schumacher, always says is, because especially in the early days of the show, that was when I lived and died a lot more on good crowd, bad crowd.
Yep.
But rough show, tough Thursday show, I'm going to have a bad weekend. And he would say, you really can't tell when you watch it. Like it all, the sound of the audience flattens out at a level that I don't think people at home are thinking, whoa, they were off the charts. So that's why you can't get too plugged into the audience because people at home aren't even experiencing that feeling of, well, it was rocking in the house.
And not only that, it's like I've had exactly the same trajectory in my time doing this Daily Show. I mean, it's so iterative, right? You got to just, it's like whenever I see interviews with like athletes, particularly baseball players, and they're just like, yeah, you go 0-for-4, then you got to come back the next day. Like if you're going like if you're going to be like upset for, you know, that it's not going to work. You got to go back. But it's also like from the viewer's perspective, it's like it's a delicious cheeseburger and they like it.
Yeah.
And they like to eat it and like you're like, "Oh, I didn't put there were supposed to be 3 pickles and not 2." And they're just like, "This is yummy. I love this. This is great. Thanks."
Right. Also, it's not episodic television where if episode 3 has a plot hole, it's just going to spin out of control by episode 17.
Exactly.
We have built shows where we get to start with a clean slate every day. So that is lovely. Also lovely, though, is we started building in like runners over the course of a week, like things that would build dumb jokes that we would talk about for a whole week because the in-studio audience, there's less of a chance they watch yesterday's show than the people at home.
Right.
The people at home who watch on Tuesday probably watch Monday. I can't say that with certainty. But a lot of times the people in the studio, maybe they like me from SNL. Maybe they do like the show. But there's a chance they're not going to get the Monday callback when you do it on Wednesday. So it was fun to build in a little bit of cinematic universe stuff.
We'll be right back with more of our future of entertainment conversation after we take this quick break.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
So So here's another question. This is a lot of technique stuff, but I'm obsessed with this. And I'm particularly obsessed, like,
of course.
The general premise here, right, is that, like, we really have gone through a once in a century experience.
Yeah.
Because we're humans and we're good at acclimating, I think we can, like we all know that and we make jokes about it and we deal with it. But I think we don't really wrestle with, like, whoa, we really went through a thing. It's going to change a lot. What's on the other side? So one of the other things I'm interested in is the other place where people use the room in comedy is the room of writers, which is a very, again, like, it's a culture. And, like, everyone, you all order lunch together and you're joking with each other. And obviously this is dramatized on 30 Rock a little bit and other places. But how that changed being remote, like the dynamics of comedy collaboration writing when people aren't in the same place.
I mostly have deep empathy for people who are at that part of their career. I'm sort of past the collaborative part
of it. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Most of the writing I do now is solitary rewriting. So it hasn't affected me that much. If anything, less people knock on my door, which is not the worst thing in the world.
Right, right.
But I feel bad that our writers aren't all together right now. I feel terrible for the current SNL writers because they haven't fully come back to their sort of classically collaborative workplace environment. There was the one that was, you know, mirrored on 30 Rock. And that was, I can't imagine having worked there for everything I went through emotionally to not have the comfort of being surrounded by a group of writers. So that I do hope comes back for people who are at that part of their career or people that are, you know, working on, you know, I have friends who work on episodic comedy writing and they say doing it on Zoom is the worst. It was so much better to be in a room because then you get the residual fun when you're not trying to break a story thing. Somebody starts doing a bit or makes you go watch a YouTube video you've never seen. That's the part that's better than the money.
Well, I have to say, as someone who has been a solitary writer in my youth, right, because I was writing articles, right, you just do that by yourself, that the experience I've had, like, I've been co-writing this TV project with a friend, and, like, that collaborative part is fun. Like, the socialization, the camaraderie, the jokes you do in between stuff, like,
yeah,
all of that, and it also kind of fires things creatively in a way that, like, you know, I've written books and I've written articles, and, like, you're just, you know, that sort of real solitary, authorial, locked in a place is just a totally different headspace.
Right. Plus, you have to come to conclusions.
Yeah. Like,
it wasn't like you were just writing short fiction where,
right,
you know, it didn't
right.
matter. And those things, when they're online, they're around forever, Chris. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, I do. I do. So you now, you know, the YouTube part of this is interesting. So you've come back and you've sort of, like, how did you choose? Again, these are technical questions, but it's the kind of thing I'm obsessed with. How did you choose what of the pandemic era Seth gets carried over into now,
mm-hmm.
even though we're still in the pandemic, and what gets left behind? Like, and how intentional were those choices?
There was a choice not to bring any bits with us. We had this, I should note, wasn't like an A-plus bit or anything. Very polarizing talking sea painting cat.
I was about to say, the iconic pandemic bit yeah. of the Seth Meyers show.
Which was basically despised from the minute we started it.
I personally loved, but...
And I hear about it. It's the perfect outcome, which is people tell me all the time they want me to bring it back, and they're all wrong, but it means the world to me. I wish they were right. They're not right.
Will you explain what the bit is just briefly? Because it's...
I was doing a show at my in-law's house. That was the second location. I did attic, then I did in-law's house. They had this sea captain painting. And just, again, I don't know anything about set dressing. And I'm thinking, what's a good backdrop for... This will be the nautical themed part of my pandemic. And then I just... So, you know Sal, who writes A Closer Look, Sal Gentile.
Yep.
I one day just decided I was going to have the sea captain say something. And then I texted Will Forte and I was like, we record this line. And he immediately sent it back. And then we had, you know, when I say animate, it just made a mouth move on the painting.
Yes. Part of the bit, by the way, which is part of what makes it funny.
Yes. It was the Pee-wee's Playhouse
yes.
of the show. And we loved it. We really loved it. It made us deeply happy. It was one of those things that in a crazy time felt like the right way to treat what we were going
yeah.
through, which was we're going to make the sea captain talk. And we didn't want to bring something like that back with us because it was of that moment and we were really happy with it. But we wanted to bring back the space we had given ourselves then to come up with something like that. I think that once we got back in the studio, before we had an audience back, Wally became the new sea captain. Wally's the cue card guy for our show as well as SNL.
Yep.
And also, Wally is genuinely good on camera and really funny. And so I started talking to Wally, and then we started writing lines for Wally. And Wally, you know, we're always cognizant of the fact that the worst thing we would do is overexpose Wally.
Right.
But that's that kind of freedom to make these choices. And then the biggest thing was, over the course of the pandemic, we started taking these wild turns within the body of A Closer Look. And A Closer Look is, you know, Sal's writing style. It's very much, I'm going to lay out a premise. I'm going to support the argument. I'm going to come to a conclusion. It's a really, he's got a really unique and special writing style for late night comedy. Yet within the body of it, over the course of the pandemic, we started taking weird curly cues and tangents and doing impressions, and but always finding our way back to it. And that was something that we never would have started trying to do in front of an audience, but because we were away from an audience and because we were appreciative of the fact that everybody was a little crazy, that there would be room to do it, and people watching it wouldn't think I'd gone crazy. They would think I know exactly what's happening here. It's happening to me too. I'm having crazy thoughts all day long. Because it was the comedy of being cooped up.
Yeah.
And so in a way that we were taught how to write it, the audience was taught how to watch it, and I think we all enjoyed it, so we decided to bring it back with us when we came back. And it was scary that first week that an audience was back. We didn't know how it would go. And the first show with an audience back was the most emotional show I feel like I had done here. Maybe top five. But not because, oh, I'm so happy an audience is back. It was the moment I realized, oh, you're the audience that was watching.
Yeah, right.
While we were gone. Like, you're not an audience, you're our audience.
Right.
And that was the best feeling ever.
Wait, there's so many things I want to say. One is that the Will Forte day drinking.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I laughed so hard.
Yeah.
Usually
the burden, I feel the burden in day drinking and why it's very stressful is I feel as though I have to find the comedy in the moment where all I was.
Right. Because it's not scripted. You're just there and the camera's rolling and the bit is that you guys are having drinks in the day and
yes.
you want it to be funny, but.
And I'm a control freak and yet I'm drinking more. So I'm losing control.
Right.
And so there's no sense of how it's going. Whereas with Will, I just felt like an audience from the second it started.
People should watch it. It's up on YouTube. There's a bit in which Will has to make you break.
Yeah.
just extremely funny.
One thing that's jarring about that, he gets very close to me.
Yes. Like, I mean, one of his recurring bits to get you to break is to come within basically half an inch of your lips with his face. And it's very effective.
Yeah. A lot of the feedback online from that is that I maybe don't have any cartilage in my nose. Because at one point he gets really close and my nose does. I hadn't noticed it. My nose does like fold in half like a paper airplane wing.
Well, day drinking is interesting because it's like, again, I think you're doing comedy in this very, like, again, this very kind of, I think, previously sort of genre-bound container, right? The late night show, which has a very specific set of formal elements. But because of the pandemic, but also because of the world we live in, like, you get to do other stuff in these different environments, kind of across platforms. And day drinking is sort of a perfect example of that, where, like, you can't do that in the late night show. It's its own kind of thing. It exists in another place. How did that come about?
We were always struggled to figure out how to do stuff out of the studio. And the problem is that I don't like not having a script. I don't, and I'm an improviser, but I don't like improvising with strangers. I remember we went out once on St. Patrick's Day to shoot something. And as I walked out, all I could think was, I'm sure Letterman did this better. I'm sure Conan did this better. I'm sure Jimmy did this better. I'm uncomfortable. I don't like being around drunk people.
Right.
I don't like any of this. And we basically, to some degree, turned around and went home. And then we've done some really great scripted things out of the studio, sketches like Boston Accent or White Savior. But those are a lot of production. They take a lot of time. We can only do about one a year. And so Day Drinking came up originally because my brother and I, we thought it'd be fun if he and I went out and we shot the two of us. And then we did one with my mom. And then it was Retta, the really funny comedian, who said she wanted to do one. And that sort of opened the gates for... And now I will say, post-Rihanna, the day drinking problem we have is a lot of people want to go day drinking. And right. I'm constantly reminded by my wife about the current age of my liver and the fact that now is not the time to... to take up binge drinking again because...
Yeah, can we book five next week? Can we book five? Can we...
Also, I will say, I'm very proud of myself because, again, this has nothing to do with me. This has to do with Rihanna, right? Everybody of any age watches Rihanna do something and they think that's a cool thing to do. Because of that, a lot of like really young, beautiful women have said, oh, I'd love to do that. And I think there at some point it's not fun watching a man my age get drunk. Even though I would be nothing but a gentleman, it would just be a gross thing to watch.
Yep.
I would not misbehave.
I think that's right. It's a great bit. And it's, you know, I think about this a lot. Like, you were a writer in SNL and then you were a head writer at SNL. And maybe I'm misreading this, but here's my sort of feeling about things. Like, I think for a long time, there was a fairly constrained set of what comedy, who did comedy and what the sort of world of comedy was. And there was a very clear hierarchy with, I think, SNL writer being up very near the top and writers on those late night shows. And it just feels like it's a real thousand flowers blooming now.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that. What's changed in a universe in which like there's a million shows and there's more comedy than ever. And I also feel like comedy just has this like ubiquitous presence in the culture, partly like podcasts. And I mean, there's just, it's sort of everywhere all the time. Even on TikTok, if I'm on TikTok, you're seeing stand-up bits all the time. You know, random people I don't even know.
That's what I feel as though I've even aged out of appreciating how much comedy is a part of TikTok and how much, not just new comedians are finding their way on TikTok, but old material is finding its way back onto TikTok. So it is nice to know that content, good content will always find a home. You just hope that good content creators are properly compensated
for it. Yep.
Because, you know, I do feel as though what used to be a back end is now it just somebody, some teen lip synced it on TikTok and you know, they got a billion views. So that part's a little scary. I mean, it's great that there are more creators out there telling different stories. And, you know, the scarier part is just shorter seasons. You know, it's being a writer on a TV show doesn't mean what it used to mean. It's almost a part-time job. So that's the part. It's almost that as soon as it becomes diverse and for everyone, it becomes a worse job.
Right.
You know, like the timing of it is like the part that seems deeply unfair.
The thing I say to people who are young journalists is that what I have watched in my life happen to journalism is for it to go to from a career a little like being like a school principal, like a good and prestigious job, but like a middle class job that like people in your town might have had.
Right.
To being an actor. Right. Like there's always going to be actors and there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of actors, but there's a real pyramid of success in acting.
Yeah.
It's very hard to sustain a middle-class job in Columbus, Ohio as an actor, right?
Right.
And it used to be the case that you could sustain a middle-class job in Columbus, Ohio, Portland, Oregon, you know, in Nebraska as a journalist at the local newspaper, and that was your job.
Yeah.
And now journalism has become more like acting, where like there's like a small amount of people who make it really big, a lot of people trying to get into it, and then a lot of churn among young people who don't have a lot of leverage or wage negotiation power.
Yeah.
And I think that's happening in more and more industries, you know, and obviously in comedy, like you got the Writers Guild, which worked very hard to create these structures for writers, but it does seem like there's some of that happening there as well.
Very much so. And it is the same problem that I think now probably more than ever is happening with journalism. Is we know, like that top tier, like with actors, we know them a little bit better now.
Mm-hmm.
So weirdly, they're that top tier success, I feel like, is like a magnet for more young people. Like,
yes.
It pulls more people in at a time where it's actually a smaller, the right. entry yes. hole is smaller.
Yes.
I mean, I should note that it's scary all over in all fields.
Right, but, totally, yeah.
But I will say, as somebody who consumes TV and films, I feel like as a viewer, it's a really exciting time to watch new things. And we just finished watching Mindy Kaling's new show, Sex Lives of College Girls, mm-hmm. which it was just great. And also it's, an incredibly diverse cast. And yet it's exactly, I know it's, I went to college, 25 years ago. It still works for me as a
yes,
white guy.
Totally.
It all rings true. And so it's this weird thing of constantly being reminded, like, everybody has a different experience. But also at our core, like, it was crazy to think that only person who looked like me who could tell a story I understood.
Yeah, I think, that's an interesting segue into, there's this very, I think, sort of tiresome meta commentary about comedy and, like, cancellation and you can't say anything anymore. And I've become, like, the person, because I'm 43 now, where, like, in our editorial meetings, I'm aging into the place of, like, you kids, like, I was like, I was talking about this with, with Rogan the other day, where it's like, I went through this with Imus and Stern and like Shock Jocks. And like, there's like a whole thing about this. Like, they were saying offensive things. They were getting a lot of attention, a very pitched cultural conversation about what is and isn't inside the line. What's the value of provocation? What's the value of like not being an offensive jerk to people all the time?
Yeah.
And like, and I'm, I guess I feel like it's not actually that complicated that you can do things that are edgy and respectful at the same time.
Yes.
Or you could do things that are edgy and also not cruel, I guess is the way I would put it.
Or you can do things that are edgy and cruel and people are going to react like you did a thing that was cruel.
Yes,
like that's
exactly.
The part I don't understand, which is, look, you're allowed to say whatever you want, but then the audience is allowed to react. There's this idea that the freedom only belongs to the person who does it in the first place. And then there's no freedom to comment. I don't understand how people... Here's the thing. If you want to do offensive comedy, what is your problem with people being offended? It seems like that's the only... Like, otherwise, you didn't do offensive comedy.
Right.
If nobody's upset... I don't, like, are people supposed to just be quietly upset?
Yeah.
So I'm deeply frustrated because it does feel like it's constantly sort of the shifting of what the boundaries are that we're even talking about here. But again, I think people do like to go out and tell a joke that is cruel. They want the points for for taking that risk. But what is the risk? Why, what, how can you say a joke is risky if there wasn't some blowback?
Right. Well, and I think you guys, so this is a thing I think is really the jokes Seth can't tell bit.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really, it's two things that I think are hard to get together, which is why I admire it. It's conceptually very smart. And it the idea is that it's you and two writers, one a white woman, one a black woman, telling jokes that you can't tell, right? This is the setup of the bit. But it's also super first order funny. And it's funny also because of the tension between the two.
Yes.
Where you're kind of pointing to where these lines are and why they exist and also playing with them, which is a hard thing to do. And I'm curious you to talk about the development of that bit because that feels like a high wire act that you pull off. I think because you're A, not trying to be cruel, B, you're fronting the thing that you're messing with in a way that sort of makes it work.
It really just came from our reality. Which is
right.
Jenny Hagel, who's this really talented writer, who is also a lesbian
right.
and also Puerto Rican, would write jokes that were really funny. But I would say to her, laughing, I would say, Jenny, I would be pilloried if I did these jokes. I can't do these jokes. Poking fun at making granular observations about lesbians. You know, I just can't do it. And she realized.
You know that kind of lesbian that comes in?
Yeah.
And, yeah right,
I was
yeah.
like, what? It would be crazy. So she agreed. It wasn't as though she was offended by it.
Right.
But then she also realized that I told her I thought they were funny, right? It wasn't that I shook my fist and said, this isn't the kind of joke we do on late night. I just said, we, problematically are stuck with me as the delivery system.
Right.
So they wrote it up and it was, we had a table read and it was out of the gates. It would have been like a movie where, you know, the guy at the soundboard, here's Johnny Cash. I, you know, looked at Shoemaker and we just both kind of nodded our head like, I think we got a hit. So it was just that simple. I mean, we just explain it as it is. And I think that it also proves a point that some comedians might disagree with, but I do think the delivery system matters of a joke.
Right.
That is a proof that it matters. And, you know, again, the joke is funny. As written, the joke is funny. It is just not fun when I say it.
You know, Ta-Nehisi has this great line about, you know, the sort of about context, language and context and who can say what. And, you know, the perennial thing of like, well, you know, Black people say the N-word and why can't I? Which I think is a pretty lame and beaten down. But, you know, he's got this great line about like, he's like, I can call my wife baby, but I can't call your wife baby. Yep. There are different contexts where different language is differently interpreted. And that's true of all language, even outside comedy.
Also, I'm also surprised people don't like figuring that puzzle out.
Mm-hmm.
So much of comedy writing is solving the puzzle. I don't believe there's any, even the most physical comedian cares about language and the order of words and where you put the emphasis on a word. And so everybody in this game cares and appreciates the value of structure. And sometimes you have to worry about the context as well.
Yeah.
It's just part of it. And by the way, I want to stress too, like, I think there is a place for offensive comedy. I think that, you know, if somebody's act is, I'm going to go out and tell jokes that no one but me has the nerve to say. If you want the reward for doing that,
right,
you have to go into it knowing that some people are going to be upset. And I just feel like, by the way, you know, and it's up to you how to deal with them, but I feel like framing yourself as a victim is the one, the version that I'm least interested in.
Yeah, I think that's what I have a hard time with too. And I think also partly, I think it's just very human too, in that like, we've just got a lot of channels for feedback. And I think there's part of the weird defensiveness I think you see sometimes in the, there's kind of can be a weird comedy guild defensiveness,
yes,
you know, around this stuff that I think is a little unsavory. But I also kind of empathize with, because there is something very vulnerable about going up and trying to get people to laugh.
Yes.
And there's something very ego destroying about being criticized for that.
100%.
But then you just got to grow up and be a bit like, people say mean things about me all the time. Like, it's just, but I'm very lucky. I'm one of the most privileged, lucky people in the country. Like, I get to do this incredible thing and talk to all these people. And so part of the price I play is that, like, people say nasty stuff about me. And, like, that's just what it is. I just got to, you know, I got to, like, look into my kids' eyes and, like, hold my wife and enjoy the things that matter and, like, not let it get in your head.
I mean, my problem is my kids say the nastiest things about me, so I got nowhere to turn.
That's why
I go to YouTube comments. That's why I
go for love. I'm getting heckled in my home.
Yeah.
So the other big transition, I feel like for you, you know, the show really kind of like blossomed in the age of Trump, you know, just in terms of where it was and the trajectory. And I think all of us had this experience of, we had bigger audiences. People were watching more. There was really this sort of collective sense, even sort of pre-pandemic, right? Like, holy Lord, like we're all watching this thing happen that we're processing all the time because it's so nuts.
Yeah.
You just kind of need to talk about it and process it. And it's so kind of surreal and unbelievable. You feel like you're in a walking dream all the time. You're constantly saying to people like, what did you? And I'm curious, like, how you thought about that and how you thought about not being in a different era now.
Well, I mean, so much of that era was the catharsis of talking about it and hoping that it was cathartic to hear.
Yep.
You know, early in that era, I feel people with jobs like mine were asked, do you really think you're changing anyone's mind? And that wasn't the goal.
No.
You know, I think it was to know there was a place where people who also thought this was crazy would convene to make jokes about it. And the hardest weeks for me during that era were when we were on hiatus and something crazy would happen. It was far easier to do the show and talk about it that way as opposed to just be, you know,
yes,
stuck on vacation looking at Twitter, which is I had to take Twitter off my phone during vacation because without an outlet, it was only the bad part of it as opposed to the bad part of it. And then let's at least make jokes.
I would say the exact same thing to people. I mean, I wasn't making jokes, but I was talking about it. And I would say to people, like, people like, oh, it must be so exhausting to be covering this. And I was like, it is, but it's also kind of like therapeutic. And like when things, you know, I'm very lucky that I get to say my piece at the end of the day about what I've witnessed. And I too take Twitter off my phone on vacation for exactly the same reason, which is that it just kind of like, it's all the input with none of the output. And the output ends up being the kind of processing mechanism to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And without that, I'm the same way. It drives me a little nuts.
Yeah. So having some place to put it was really valuable. And now, you know, as much as I think we're on the other, I mean, I don't really feel like we're on the other side.
I don't think
and,
we are.
You know, a criticism that that I would get from people who are not, let me just say this. People say, why are you still talking about Trump?
Yeah, same. I get the same.
I'm talking about him because he's still the head of your party.
Yeah.
And I think he's coming back.
Yes.
And until he stops talking, I promise I'll stop talking.
Yeah.
I promise I will.
Yeah.
And yet he won't. So
there was even a little period, you know, after January 6th and after he left, I remember there being a few months where it was like, he was in Mar-a-Lago. Everyone had kind of been like, that was really rough.
Yeah.
And there was a period where like, we weren't talking about him. It's like,
yeah.
And then he basically began to kind of reassert his primacy over one of the two major parties in America. And it was like,
yeah,
well, the guy that tried to overthrow American democracy for the first time since the Civil War, basically.
I mean, again, I wish it would be very unfair to compare his, you know, first year and a half out of office to Obama's first year and a half out of office.
Yes.
So anyone who's wondering why we're still talking about him, that hopefully that's an answer. And I think now that they've heard you and I say it, I think they'll finally agree. I think the people that are mad that we're still talking about Trump just needed to hear us explain ourselves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's done now. That's done. So you have a baby.
Yeah.
How old is your baby?
You can't call her baby. I can call her baby. Child, please. No, she's 5 months old.
That's great. Yeah. And so you.
That's great.
It's your third.
Yes.
I just aged out of like potty training, sleep, like all of the stuff that comes with like very young children.
Yeah.
And it's sad because that's such a beautiful part of life. It's one of the most precious things a human can experience. And it's also one of the most unremittingly exhausting things that you.
What was the gap between 2 and 3 for you, the years?
So my kids are 10, 8, and 4. So there's 4 years between.
So similar. We had 3.5 years. So we were out of it and then we restarted it.
Right. Yeah.
Which you were as well.
Yes. We had aged out of it and then.
Yeah, restarted the clock. And the only thing I'll say is, going through it this time, all of the things that are bad are still bad, but knowing it's the last one, having watched the other two aged out of it, and weirdly, this having a nostalgia for a thing you thought it was impossible to have nostalgia for.
Totally.
So
you're like, oh, this poop
yeah,
in this diaper.
Yeah,
a real blowout.
Look at us here. So we are, you know, and it should be noted, this. The burden, certainly in the first 5 months, is so much more on the mother than the father. But
particularly if she's nursing and breastfeeding.
Yes, yeah. Which she is. So for us, the harder part for me is coming, but it's still, we're just so happy that we get to do it one more time. And, you know, we obviously got really lucky that it's a girl. And she does have the vibe of someone who's aware that there's a lot going on. And she seems to be saying, look, check in with me when I'm a teenager. I will work through all that stuff with you then.
my youngest, similar vibe. And I think we just went on vacation last week and we were down this place by the beach and there were some young parents with their, you know, that there's a 5-month-old on the beach, you know, having their first vacation with a baby. The first vacation with a baby is like such a rude awakening because you're like, oh, because like you go from being like, you know, in our case, you know, 30 years old and on vacation, you sleep till 10:30 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like up at 5:30 and you're like, we're not really doing vacation. We're doing childcare in a different setting.
Yeah.
Like this is not going to be what vacation used to be. Yeah. And watching these parents, I just remembering like how psychotically neurotic the culture in certain socioeconomic and certain cultural spheres is about raising your first kid.
Yeah.
And all the messages about how high stakes it is and how you have to do it right or you're going to screw up. And they're just this like very intense. And I do think that one of the nice things by the time you work your way to three is like, I just didn't feel any of that anymore. It was just like, we kind of know what we're doing. And I'm not like taking the LSAT here. You know, if I get it wrong, I'm going to be judged and get a bad grade on being a parent, which is very much the message you get, I think, in that when you first have a kid.
Then it's also, for example, I don't think we played Mozart once and held it to my wife's belly. So if she's the only one that's not a classically trained musician.
That's why.
That'll be why. The other thing is that no one tells you is when you, I don't know if you were like this, but when you have your first, the worst sound a baby can make is nothing.
Yes.
Like you just can't, I couldn't sleep.
Yep.
I just, the amount that I wanted to check on, because again, you know, it was the first time in your life that you were in charge of another person's well-being at that level. And now you just, you know, because you're like, baby sleep.
Yeah.
When they sleep, God, the best thing in the world would be if they don't make a peep. And she's a good sleeper. And so we're very lucky so far in regards to that.
How long do you want to host late night television?
Well, it's weird. I'm coming up on 10 years a lot faster than I thought it would come. We just had our 8th anniversary. And we've got a couple more years. And if you think of it in chunks of 5, I would like to think I have another 5 in me, at least. And mostly because it goes so fast.
It does.
And the other thing, and again, you know, silver linings. I remember my first year on the show, Paul Schaefer was here. And he said, how's it going? And I said, it's great. It's never boring. And he said, give it time. And I think that was the thing, right? The risk of doing these shows, unlike SNL, which SNL never gets boring because the host just changes it too much.
Yep.
Each week is so, so different based on that. And here it's not. But the pandemic was this weird, thrilling reset as far as what the show was. And so I liked the show a lot, what it was right before the pandemic. But I like what it is now even more.
That's
and
great.
So as long as you can see growth, I don't think there's a reason to stop. I think these are shows you stop when, and by the way, I think it's impossible to continue to grow. At some point, you just go, all right, you know, this is, I don't have any other moves in the toolbox. But right now, it does feel like something where I would like to keep doing it for a while longer.
April 1st will be our 9th anniversary doing All In. And I've been keeping this list. I've been joking to Kate about things that I've been hosting All In longer than, which includes like the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, both world wars, even Vietnam, the Beatles recording, and Seinfeld, which was on air for 9 seasons.
Wow.
And it's funny because your sense of time, like I've been thinking about this a lot with the Beatles, where it's like they weren't together that long. Small amounts of time can produce incredibly long lasting. And, you know, it's really wild to think, I totally agree with you about how the time goes so fast. It's just incomprehensible to me that I've been doing this for this long.
Also, you, I would imagine you also have your show number on each script. Like that number is crazy to me. Like what tonight we'll be doing whatever, 1269, let's say. And that is mind boggling. Because I still remember when it was show 7.
Right.
And you could remember what show 1 was.
Well, I hope you guys keep doing it. I am genuinely a fan.
I do. I think you were fishing for it. So I will say I do consider you the Seinfeld of MSNBC.
I think I'm the Seinfeld of NBC. You know? I think NBC.
You're NBC.
By the way, have you ever been? Have you ever been? This is a fun thing. In one of the dining rooms in 30 Rock, like one of the fancy ones that I've been in like once, where like the Comcast people, you know, decides who lives and who dies. Like that there is the notes from the Seinfeld pilot read or a pitch. There's it's a great document. It's a frame document and it's executive notes on a Seinfeld, either the pitch or the pilot that's like, this is not very good and I don't see this working. And it's framed and it's up in the dining room. It's great.
I was you know, we get tested every day and there's on the floor I get tested. It's the perfect thing for a corporation to do with content, which is stenciled on these little rooms that you wait are lines from movies. And so
I know exactly that floor.
So I was, you know, the room I wait for my test has says we're on a mission from God. And I just love like everything the Blues Brothers was about to one day be stenciled on a little cubicle with like one chair and a corporate phone. But then I told that to somebody and they said on the morning that, you know, because Jimmy and I both got COVID around the same time. So the morning he came into work and tested positive for COVID, his door said, "What you talking about, Willis?" Which is just the perfect.
Seth Meyers is the host, of course, of Late Night with Seth Meyers. He's a comedian, a writer, a producer, an actor, and a dad and a husband. And this was fantastic, Seth. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. I'll see you soon. Come visit us again.
Definitely. Once again, my great thanks to Seth Meyers. It was really great to talk. I love Seth. I just think he's such a mensch, I gotta say. You know, one of my favorite people in all of this world that I live in. And I don't have a ton of interactions with other people that host television shows. Rachel's a good friend of mine. So it's a small sphere, but he's just a great guy. Our four-part With Pod Future of miniseries continues. Next up in our feed, Kathy Wood, who's the founder, CEO, and CIO of ARK Invest on the future of innovation.
I don't think we'll be able to get away from artificial intelligence. I think we need to get on the right side of change here, make sure that we've got the right experts focused on the potential problems, but then run with the solutions that it offers.
Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.